Forests, Managing the Future. This is the second forum in the 2012 Fenner School Forum Series, hosted by the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University. This forum took place on the 3rd of May 2012.
Thank you all for your patience. Is that... Actually, I should note that it was mostly past and present Fenner students who were kept talking at the start of the lecture. I'm Steve Dovers, the director of the Fenner School, and I'll welcome. Someone else will be running the show. But thanks very much for coming. The last one of these, we had more RSVPs than people who turned up, and today we had more people turn up than RSVPs, so there's a prediction problem here which we'll work on with a quantitative model. And before we begin, I would acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose land we meet today and one of the world's oldest living cultures, and pay my and our respects to their elders past and present. This is one of a series of fora around major areas of natural resource management, environmental management and land management. Forests is our focus today, and over the coming months we'll do some more. And the purpose of these is to, for our sake, for other people's sake, to explore issues around, as I put it, are we actually developing the skills now that we are going to need in 5, 10, 20 or 50 years, which we find an important question, and obviously other people find it important as well. And I would point out that some of the issues in managing forested landscapes, in agriculture, in a number of other areas are very familiar, of a very difficult match between past, present, supply, demand, needs. So I think it's a good discussion to have. A couple of reminders. At the end, we will decamp to the other building. There are two ways to get there, so follow one of two conga lines towards some food and drink in the new Frank Fenner building. And just to remind people, if you put your card or make up a card, write your name and your number, there's actually a prize of a nice bottle of wine for some lucky individual, which we'll draw over there later. And if you don't join us later, someone else will get it. But to run the show, Dr. Chris Brack, who many of you know, but is, I think enough of you know Chris, and he's going to speak, so you get a very good idea of who he is, where he is now, and possibly where he has been for the past 3 years. So thank you, Chris.
Okay, thank you, and thanks for all coming. I have the wonderful responsibility of trying to keep the speakers in line, and also, more importantly, trying to keep you guys in line at the end. So I am going to have the speakers. They're going to get a short period of time. They get 5 minutes, and then I hit them with a stick. So they've got to stop talking, which means we've got plenty of time at the end for you guys to talk and ask questions at the end. However, I still have the same stick. So if you try to have position statements that last for 35 minutes, you'll get lots of thumping. So there's fair warning, and I may reply that later on. So I get the first few minutes as well because I got up here first. Do we have the professional skill base to manage our forested landscapes in the future? First of all, I am a graduate of this proud institution, and I can see us going forward in the future very bravely. Or not, as the case may be. My sons love that machine. Everybody else thinks I'm a nerd. However, I did get my professional training here, and it's led me to a whole range of places. Most recently, it led me to New Zealand. I've spent 3 years in New Zealand, where I was charged with raising the research profile for the Wairikiki Institute. I ended up being the director of research there, working with Māori cultural development, working with nursing and health studies, working in computer sciences, and occasionally with forestry. So that professional degree led me there. There's a whole range of other things. Now, some of our panellists later on will tell you the same thing. The forestry degree has led them places that they never expected. So it didn't necessarily lead you into the profession. It can lead you other places. While I was in New Zealand, it was interesting because Wairikiki taught the old diploma of forestry. They taught the dirt foresters, the people who worked in the field, the people who needed to know the actual soil conditions, who needed to know roading networks, who needed to know all that stuff. And at University of Canterbury, they taught the professional foresters. So they had that viewpoint. Now, the Wairiki degree was 2 years. The University of Canterbury degree was 4 years, traditional forestry course. If you want, you could go from the Wairiki diploma and you would get credit of about 6 months to the professional degree. Now, the thing is, everything in that diploma was relevant to good forestry. And yet, there was another 4 years worth of work, or 3.5 years worth of work at the minimum, to bring you up to a well-rounded forester as a professional forester. So, already, the New Zealand system, which is not quite a nice system, it takes you 5.5 years to be a good dirt and professional forester. There's an awful lot of stuff. What is that stuff? What do the professionals need to know? What do we work with? As I said, I came from this institution. I graduated in 1981, and even then, we had debates on what we should be doing in this place. And every year we said 4 years is too long. The way to solve it is put more things into the course. You need to do everything you're doing, plus do wildlife surveys, because you can't manage a forest if you don't know about wildlife surveys. You need to put in environmental law and environmental policy, because you can't manage a forest without doing that. You need to put in. And we just kept adding and adding and adding. Now, what do you add in? My experiences in Wairiki is that they still teach chainsaw maintenance, would you believe? Foresters don't use chainsaws much these days, but students like to use them. But what might be more important for harvesting, for harvesters, is to be a software programmer. Because remote-controlled drones in a forest are almost a reality. They're not far away. So you may be sitting in your cabin working out how to run simulation software with all the expensive machinery out there. So should a good forester, a good professional, know something about simulation modelling, know something about software engineering? Is that where the future goes? Do we need to have more psychology in the professional foresters? I had an apology from someone who can't make tonight's meeting, but they said they needed to realise that foresters have two big roles as well. They have a leadership role as well as a management role. The leadership roles are different to management. Management is do what you're doing and do it well. Leadership is do something different. Should that be in our professional forestry curriculum? So we can always add. It's wonderful. We can always add. But in 1999, what I like is then the Commissioner for Forestry New South Wales, Hans Drielsma, came down to a nice, Max Jacob oration, said, there's lots of things people do in forests that actually do better than foresters. Engineers build better roads than foresters can. You know, professional wildlife surveys can count animals better than foresters can. But there's two things that foresters can do that no one else does. Mensuration, silviculture. I really, really like Hans's summary because I teach mensuration and silviculture. So I've got a job for life. However, it's no longer true that foresters are the only ones who do that. We now teach mensuration, not under that name, it's measurement and modelling, quantifying the state. And the class has a very, very small forester component, but a much bigger component of lawyers. Lawyers now know you have to measure stuff. They now know the understanding of variabilities. We've got like a Bachelor of Arts students in there. My first unusual student was a fine arts student studying forest measurement. Came second top. Could have been embarrassing if he was better than the entire class. Same with the silviculture. Foresters are a very small component and others are out there. So what are professional foresters best at? How do we define the professional forester anymore? Do we go back to, say, the model of the old Bachelor of Arts? In the old days, you got a Bachelor of Arts to prove you could think. And once you got one, then you went and did on-job learning. But it didn't matter what you did in your BA, just get one. And then you go on. Is that where we're off to? One thing I've always thought about forestry is we're a profession, not a discipline. And because partly we're a multidisciplinary area. Now, this is a recent report coming out from the Australian Australian Society of Learned Academies, who are talking about interdisciplinary research. And the reason I like that is because the definition of it seems to be very close to what we have to do. Natural and social scientists collaborating with community groups and policymakers to tackle complex environmental problems. And then they give a few examples. Surely that's a forest these days. That's got to be complex. It's not clearly defined, but however they define it, we still don't quite know what interdisciplinary research is, so we didn't quite know what interdisciplinary education is. It probably includes the difficulty of the problem, and surely forests are one of those difficult things we've got out there. The number and diversity of perspectives, get six people in a room, you've got 12 ideas and perspectives, and the degree of engagement of people who need to implement the results. So professionals for future management, I also took out from that report the core elements of interdisciplinary research or interdisciplinary education. This is where we're going. We need difficult problems. We need to tackle them. We need to define our students in terms of how they can react and interpret the different perspectives. We need to work as individuals and teams. We have to engage with the end users, we have to achieve policy, practice, all those sorts of things on the forest of the state. So there's a range of what our professionals in the future will require interdisciplinary. Do we just say interdisciplinary research that is on areas that could contain trees? Is that now the definition of a professional forester? Do we still need menstruation silviculture for all our graduates? What if that's all you've got, and then you've got majors and other things? These are the issues that we in the school are having to come to terms with. So that was my take on the future. I'm not sure where I'm going. I reckon I've got a full-time job, I hope. There's enough stuff out there for quantitative natural resource people. But they may not be called foresters for much longer. I'm not sure. So that's my overview. What I'm going to do now is hand over to our next panellist, who also gets 5 minutes, to talk about... Yeah, I'm a cheer, I can do that. To talk about his experiences and his vision or understanding of the potential. So, Tony, I'll let you...
It had to be a speed presentation, because you didn't tell me it was only 5 minutes, but...
Oh, of course we did.
Anyway, while he's finding it, I'm Tony Bartlett. Many people know who I am. Worked as a forester for more than 35 years. And it's nice now to be one of the older people with grey hair and seeing other young speakers to speak after me who will probably say things a lot more intelligent than I can say. When I started off in forestry in 1973, the Victorian School of Forestry at Creswick, I had no idea I'd work in international forestry issues. I haven't spent my whole career in it, but some of the most interesting and rewarding parts of my career have certainly been in international forestry. So I wanted to talk not about what you do in Australia, but what the opportunities are outside of Australia. And as the title says, there's so much to learn about international forestry, and there's so much that Australians can contribute. I was going to talk briefly about my day job, but I'll jump over some of this, otherwise I'm going to go more than 5 minutes. But just to show you that ACR, where I currently work, I'm managing the forestry program there. We're currently working in 7 countries, and we're expanding into another 2 in two areas, East Africa, 4 countries, and Nepal as well. So lots of different places where we need people to work on scientific research projects in a collaborative way with people from overseas. And basically the programs covers pretty well all the work that one could imagine in the broad forestry discipline. So just quickly jump over this. Right up to the forest industry, so the whole value chain, because people in these countries that we work in need help and assistance everywhere from starting to grow the trees right up through to processing the wood products and all the environmental issues thrown in there as well. They ask for everything, and then how it links with agriculture and food production and so on. Okay, so some of the contributions. I've got 2 slides here that I'll spend most of my 5 minutes on. So as Ken Shepherd knows, because he was involved with me on the Nepal-Australia Forestry Project, very significant achievement from Australian foresters over a very long period of time. We've also made major contributions to the UN forest processes. not just things that I've been involved in, but lots of other people. Very significant papers prepared for on forest conservation, etc. The definition that's in the intergovernmental non-binding agreement on forests, whatever it's called, non-legally binding instrument on forests, contains some words about sustainable forest management, which was largely articulated by Australians in that process. We had a leading role in the formation of the International Forest Research Centre, CIFOR, where Peter Konoski's headed off to now. John Turnbull was the first Deputy Director General there, and Australia really helped get that institution going. And we've had long-term support by people, some of whom are in this room, with the other forestry centre, the Agroforestry Centre. ACR's been going for 30 years. There's now more than 150 completed projects, so a great body of knowledge that we've helped contribute into that international sphere, and also associated with that a lot of postgraduate training and building long-term networks. Some very substantial achievements, scientific achievements related to domestication of acacia and eucalyptus plantation. You might see that picture down the very bottom on the left there. I was just recently in Rwanda, and I couldn't believe my eyes as I was driving around there. It looked like Australian landscape. Not because they had all these eucalypts planted in straight rows, but just eucalypts were all over the place there. And quite good genetics as well. And, you know, that germplasm distribution, not just acacia and eucalyptus, but a whole lot of other species, was really facilitated by the Australian Tree Seed Centre, which sadly, like a lot of our institutions, is no longer given as sufficient resources. Everywhere I go, when I'm working with people overseas, they ask, can we get more help with Australian germplasm? And then we've been working on other things like agroforestry and tropical forestry and so on. So lots of things that Australian forest scientists and other people who work in the forestry discipline have contributed to. So then what are the opportunities and constraints that we've currently got? And really this is my pitch, I suppose. So I've got a program that I manage, which at the moment is about, or when I came into the job a couple of years ago, it was about 4 million, it's up to 6 million. And this, because the Australian government is doubling its contribution to overseas development assistance, it's continually growing. And I'm struggling to find people to work on some of these projects. You can't just start off in international forestry leading a project. You need to get your experience somewhere. And it's very difficult to find people to work on some of these projects. So there's also lots of opportunities. A lot of us international students, and I can see some here in the room, want to come and study in Australia. And one way of getting here is by being involved in projects that Australia's been supporting. It's not the only way, but it does bring quite a number of students here. So some of the high priorities, from my perspective anyway, you can see them there, the links between agroforestry and food security. I'm just starting a brand new project in four countries in East Africa that's all about the role that trees have in increasing the soil productivity. And the quick science is that by growing certain trees, you can double or triple the crop yields on those sites without putting any fertiliser or anything else on. So imagine if you can roll that out over large landscapes in parts of Africa, what that could do to people's livelihoods. Access to Australian germplasm. Again, if we accept that there's a changing climate, all these other countries that are using Australian germplasm, and often with species that we don't necessarily use commercially, they want access to our germplasm at the extreme ends of the climate and to be able to test and work out what they should do to deal with the changing climate. So great roles there for Australians to help with that sort of work. The role of smallholders in commercial tree growing. I know Sir Dananan will be happy to see that, wherever he is, down there on the list, but that's a critical point. If you think about what's happening to the world's forests overall and where the future management directions are, where is the wood fibre going to come from? And people can make good money if they have good management systems, but in a lot of cases they need a lot of help to actually get the right germplasm, the right silviculture, the right markets, etc., etc. The role of forests in climate change, well, Australia is doing quite a lot in that area now, and there's, again, when I travel, people ask, could we have a project on red, or could we have a project on how to deal with a changing climate for our trees? We don't know when they're seeding, what the changing climate's going to do, all those sorts of things. Also, it's a bit of a surprise to me, and this is an area where we're very challenged in, but lots of the partner countries we work in want assistance in improving their forest industries. Their processes are just so rudimentary in most cases. But where do we find the people with expertise in wood science now? They're in very, very thin supply. And last one, but not the least important, is where I got my start in international forestry and in sort of community forestry attitudes. or projects. That's still a very important area. So it may be more than 5 minutes, but I couldn't go any faster than that. Thank you.
Tony was initially concerned that that presentation would be too much about overseas, but we decided that it's really appropriate because that is Australia's future as well. It's all integrated with the overseas as well. So that is part of where our professionals end up. Next, Dr. Chris Weston. I'll let you do your own introduction.
Thank you very much, Chris. And thanks to the Defence School for the invitation to be part of this forum tonight, and to Steve and for Chris for organising that. I've got a positive message to sell, and that is that forest science and forestry is in good shape and has a bright future, and that it's not packaged in university systems and in the education system in the way it used to be, and that the main challenge that we have is to maintain the positive side of forest science, forestry and forestry education, and to keep sending that message of the opportunities that Tony just spoke about to the potential audience of people that are coming through into the forest science game. As an educator, I see my role as to be part of a system that's making opportunities for people. And the opportunities in forest management and in forestry and broader land management in general, skills where skills are required that are embodied in forest science curricula, that's the job that we've got. What are the key elements of the bright future? It's the young people. Somewhere around 5% of university graduates are strongly motivated in environmental sciences, and our job is to project for them. The other element is that forestry as a profession and as a unique forest management is international, and the way we imagine forest management and forestry in Australia is slightly different from the way it's imagined elsewhere, but bringing it all together and bringing students from different backgrounds into forestry curriculum in different parts of the world is one of the biggest opportunities that forest educators have to sell an interesting course or project an interesting course to young people. It's that fusion of cultures and of challenges that really is a very positive message and one of the most compelling aspects of forest science education in university. I guess from the point of view, our view at the University of Melbourne, as in other, as here at ANU, we've had to address the question of how do we repackage our forest programs to keep people coming into them. And one of the consequences of that is that we have somewhat generalised the materials so that people can pick and choose what we would call from a traditional forestry curriculum, perhaps not end up with the 100% of it that all of the old diehard foresters say is absolutely required as a forest science graduate, but it's certainly bringing in the people to study forest science. We've got just as many full-time student load forest science students in Melbourne now as we had 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It's just their age at a graduate level. And more importantly, and what's exciting for us as educators, is that the people who are coming in are the arts graduates. They are the graduates from disciplines who you traditionally associate with being attracted to a forest science education. And these people are bringing enormous change and a lot of positive things, a lot of positive talents, new talents, into forestry and forest science. And they're exiting from forest science education with some of the key essential aspects of forestry education, and then combining that with their life experience and their prior education to bring new perspectives to forest management. I can't think of a more exciting land management perspective to have than one which is named from training and addressing some of the challenges that we have in forestry. So many of the skills and knowledge that society needs, such as the way we approach fire and manage fire, the way we think about fire, the way we think about managing landscapes for hydrology and workflow, and I could go on, are core disciplines of forestry. And the trick or the challenge for us is to take those skills and broaden them across university curricula and put them into the Australian consciousness, not as a cell of foresters and forestry in one corner, but more generally throughout the profession. That's 5 minutes.
Thank you. Well done. Excellent.
This is in conjunction with the IFA, who had a program of looking at forestry through the generations, and the last three speakers, I suppose, we're baby boomers, but you might stretch us to Generation X if you're being very, very nice to us. So we're going to walk down to the next generation to have another view at forestry. So I'll let you do your own introduction, Linda. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mel, for those of you who don't know me. There are some people here that I recognise, even some that I went through uni with. I'm a ex-forestry student here from ANU. I was asked to talk about how my education prepared me or didn't prepare me for my working career. So I think there's a couple of people in the room that might recognise some of these photos, I think. So I thought I'd just briefly describe what I've done in the last 10 years or so. I started my forestry degree here at ANU in 2002, and I graduated in 2005. I then stayed on for an extra year to do my honours and finished that in 2006. During my time here at ANU, when I was studying, I tried to get a bit of work experience where I could. I did a little bit of work with CSIRO, which included a bit of field work. And I spent a couple of summers in the fire crew here in the ACT, mostly pruning lots of radiata, so it's very fit. And I also spent a summer in Tumut, working with Forest New South Wales, mostly in site prep. I started as a consultant at GHD at the end of 2006, and I've been there ever since, and mostly working in forestry or natural resource management, but also working on projects that have absolutely nothing to do with natural resource management, GHD being a huge company full of engineers and architects and a handful of foresters. Get dragged into a few other areas occasionally. I also started my PhD in 2009, part-time, and I hope, fingers crossed, to finish in 2015. Bit of a long haul, I'm halfway there. So how did my education prepare me for the challenges that lay ahead in my work life? I guess, firstly, it provided me with some technical skills. I might not have remembered all the details. Actually, I'm pretty sure I didn't, but at least it gave me a starting point. I knew where to look for information if I needed to find it. I had research skills developed here, most importantly, time management skills. I think I learnt that most in my honours year. As a consultant, we're often working to extremely tight deadlines, and we're producing products that a client is paying for, so you want to make sure that it's the best work that you can do in a short time frame. So time management skills, I think I learnt the most at uni. Communication skills, particularly report writing, and it might sound weird, but computer skills. While I was at high school and college, we didn't do a lot on computers, so learnt about several different programs that I use every day. I never saw PowerPoint before I got to uni, so there we go. Just a couple of specific examples. When I started at GHD, I mostly did a lot of inventory work in blue gums across Australia, and so my classes with Chris, what did we call it? Ecological Measurement and Modelling. At least I knew what some of the equipment looked like. So when someone gave me a dye tape and a vertex, I at least knew they existed. Might not have remembered how to use them, but it wasn't a complete shock. And some of the work that I did with CSIRO helped me with that as well. And we did a little bit of plantation management, salvage operations and thinning operations. So my fourth year here at uni was probably the best to prepare me for that, where we did a lot of forest management classes. However, I think what prepared me the most for my working career was really the many different field trips that we got to go on while we were here at uni, and also the work that I got to do during my holidays. That just provided me with that link between what we were learning in class every day and how it could actually be applied out in the real world. So that sort of leads me to my next point, and perhaps some people might challenge me on this, students in particular. But coming straight out of school and going into uni, I didn't sort of maybe have the, or some of us might not have had the courage or the confidence to seek out a lot of real life experience. And I think some of us maybe need a little bit of a push. If I got the chance to go back to uni now and redo my degree, I think I'd get a lot more out of it than I did back then. But unfortunately, that's not the way things work sometimes. So although this might sound harsh, I actually think that students need to have some sort of compulsory component to their classes where they need to go and do some real life experience. We didn't have to do that when we went through, but I really do think that that would be beneficial, particularly for the younger students who haven't had real life experience, like me. That actually came up in some work that Zoe Ryan was doing with the IFA. I don't know if Zoe's here. I've never met her before, so no. Anyway, where she was looking at some of the younger forestry students and seeing what sort of experience that they needed. And that came up as a need, where students really needed to gain that experience in the industry. Also, some sort of mentoring or buddy program would have been nice, where you were sort of forced to actually buddy up with someone who knew what they were talking about. That would have been good, bit of a push. So yeah, I guess my main point is that I think that some sort of exposure to the industry prior to starting work is invaluable in linking with what you're learning in class and how it's actually applied in the real world. And some sort of focus on that is essential.
And our last panellist before the panel discussion forum is a current student, just to give us our current viewpoint on where the profession is heading.
So, my name is Ellie Cheney. I'm currently a third year undergraduate forestry student here at the ANU, and consequently I'm also the last undergraduate forestry student at the ANU. I'm the only one in my cohort, and after my year, the forestry program was all changed, and so this is an interesting experience. But I just submitted a big assignment this morning, so I don't have any PowerPoint slides or anything pretty, but I'll just be talking to you for a little while. So firstly, I actually also wanted to touch on the study that that Mel was talking about. And I think it's really interesting that you said you thought there needed to be a bit more industry exposure and work exposure during the degree, because that's something that did come up in the study, and a lot of students said that that's something they would like to see. And in my own experience currently studying, that is something that I would also like to see. I feel like, although the classes are very interesting and field trips are fantastic, it would be really great to go out and see some more actual real world experience, what we might actually be doing after the degree. I think I also wanted to touch back on what Chris said earlier, Chris Brack, about the fact that there's a bit of a generation gap between foresters. So the older generation and the upcoming generation, in terms of the knowledge that we have, while there appears to be nowadays less of a focus on the specifics of forestry as a profession, so the menstruation and the culture, and more of a broad overview of things like policy and of what's happening overseas. And so I just wanted to comment that I thought it was interesting that perhaps it's not so much a lack of knowledge on either side, but a couple of different knowledge sets, and that generation gap may just be the overlap that's not quite being, hasn't quite been addressed. So I guess in terms of how my degree has been progressing so far, I think the most interesting thing that I've been exposed to, or one of the biggest highlights, I suppose, has been my involvement with the International Forestry Students Association, which has started last year. And I think already through my experience with the association, I've been over to Finland to their annual symposium, and I've been to the Asia-Pacific Forestry Week conference in Beijing at the end of last year, and that was really interesting, not only seeing how forestry is managed in different countries, but also seeing just exactly what is out there in terms of all of these big organisations such as C4 and the FAO, who are doing a whole lot of really interesting research and running really interesting projects, and all of these things that I had no idea about but were really interesting. And I guess that also comes back to the idea of getting more experience of things outside of uni. I think that perhaps it's to do with the declining numbers, but students need to seek that out more themselves nowadays. Whereas we hear stories about some of the earlier generations of forestry, you do have a lot of industries with backing and the cadetships and scholarships. Nowadays it seems to be more something that you need to search out for yourself. So yeah, I don't really have much more to say. I think, just to finish up, it's also touching back on what Chris Weston was saying. While the specific forestry degree is declining in numbers, I think it's important to consider the fact that there are also a lot of students coming out with more general resource management and environmental science degrees who still have an interest in forestry. And while they might not have the specific title, there are still a lot of people coming out potentially into the industry who have a lot of the basic skills and might need a bit more of the training and the specifics, but they're still keen to learn, and there's still a lot of potential to be tapped in that sense. So sorry, I wasn't more prepared. I would have liked to have been, but I guess assignment's cool. So all I have to say for the moment.
So we just to prove to you, as a real life current student, we made sure she had assignments due this morning. So thanks for that. Okay, the speakers, all except me, kept well to time, so thank you for that. We started a bit late, but we've still got, if we go for an hour after when we started, we've got about 20, 25 minutes for panel. So I'll just ask the speakers to come up, and we'll have a panel discussion. We did try the inbuilt overhead speakers, microphones last week, and it failed. Well, last time we ran this, failed dismally. We had well-recorded mumbles, and that was all we got. So we're going to have a highly sophisticated system where the panelists get a microphone, and the people who are going to ask brief, relevant questions, who've had no more than 60 to 90 seconds, get a microphone as well. So if you promise that your question is interesting and relevant, and you can direct to someone, great. If not, bad luck. You'll get a microphone. So that was the topic. Where is forestry for Australia going in the future? And do we have the professional skills necessary to manage that estate in the future? Anyone wants to start us? So, yes, you do, because we're recording you. Maybe you don't, because I can't turn it on. I can't turn it on. All right, you don't need a microphone.
I share Chris Justin's view that water science and the fact that you can think of the world. I'm in the right position to move from agronomy to forest science after my postdoctoral. So, But I was just wondering, if there was a CEO of a forest industry in this forum, on the other side, and if he or she heard the presentations of the five speakers, what would be that person's response or thinking, the way you people are articulating the contemporary view of forestry?
I'll have a crack at that, Savandan. That's quite a leading question, because I think CEOs of forestry, and I presume you mean somebody in the forest industry, are driven by the bottom line of forestry business. That's right, of making a dollar out of the forestry game. And well, in terms of plantation and native forestry, and in terms of turning out timber products, I think there have been a lot of challenges in the marketplace over the last 5 years in particular that make it very difficult for some of the, at least on the hardwood side of the game, forestry CEOs to be positive about what's going on because of global financial crisis, because of rising Australian dollar, and so on. But if I were a CEO who employed forest knowledge in my business, which might be a water business or a biodiversity or wildlife management business, I would be applauding the skills of the people who keep coming up to help with that task.
I'll just make one quick comment. I guess if I look back on my undergraduate training, probably nothing, or almost nothing, that I learned in that I actually used in real jobs. So that may be a bit too blunt. But the reality is, what we're training people to do is to think, to understand the systems, and to want to continue to learn. And most of the skill set that you need to do any job, if I think about my career, has been learnt during that job. But you come with a particular underlying skill set sort of thing. So I'm not so pessimistic. I just wish the CEOs of Australian forest businesses would actually start investing and supporting a few more students.
And we're sitting here tonight. So no follow-ons yet. You can ask another round if there's no more questions. Sorry.
Yeah, hi. Ryan Jones, University of Sydney. It seems to me that there are declining numbers of students going into forestry-related courses. So what is the forestry industry doing for workers these days if we're running out of graduates? And if we're getting workers from overseas, which countries are they coming from? And if they're coming from countries where they have an excess of graduates with forestry skills, what are they doing that we're not?
Well, I'll have first go then while they fight over the mic. The first issue there is what's a forestry course. And some of those courses don't have declining numbers. As I said, my measurement and modelling course, we're healthy at 25, 30 students enrolled 6 months out of the course at the moment. Only two or three foresters doing it, but they're doing forestry courses. So what do you mean by a forestry course? What packages are you talking about? But yes, to employ foresters with a named forestry degree, you get them from South America, South Africa, or New Zealand. So I've graduated a few. Thank you.
I argue that there's just as many people coming in to study forest sciences, at least at the university I work at now, as there has been ever since the mid-90s, perhaps was a peak. But those people, going back to Tony's point, you know, we've benefited. The people who have graduated in forestry and forest science over the last 30 years have generally come through with a strong science background and a strong basis for tackling problems in land management from a first principles point of view because of their strength in biology and chemistry and the traditional sciences. We've got people coming from a broader range of backgrounds now who may not be able to bring to bear that first principles way of tackling land management issues, forestry issues, but they have a broad range of other skills that are required. So I'm not sure whether that answers your question, but I think the students are still lining up, and they're still coming out with forest related degrees and knowledge. Yeah.
Tony talked about the role of foresters in climate change. We've talked about measurement and monitoring. Chris, I understand you've had some involvement in Tasmania with the forest carbon study that's due to come out at the end of the month for the report. Do you think that, for example, with FSC and the social chamber, Do you think there's some evidence on the table that might be able to take some emotion out of the debate about what emissions are coming from logging operations and what standing forests are worth in terms of carbon values?
No. Science doesn't take emotions out of forestry, I'm afraid. Whatever. Yeah, facts and emotions are often irrelevant. We have to talk the right language, I think. Numbers aren't emotive. You have to somehow get a different way of presenting the numbers. I mean, I like numbers, I understand numbers, I've worked with them all the time, and I know when 10 means 10 and when it means a bit more than 9. But there's a lot of people out there who do not understand numbers, especially when we start talking about gigatons. Who knows how much a gigaton is? Who can visualise a gigaton? And is that more than a metric ton? Yeah. 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 It's one of those interesting things is as scientists, professional foresters are good at understanding numbers, understanding the uncertainties around numbers, even when they're presented, certainly. But as communicators, we fail badly. And simply putting the numbers on the table won't help. There's a whole other story around it. Which I think is that earlier comment I had about the difference between management and leadership. Leaders don't lead by spreadsheets. Managers might manage with spreadsheets, but leaders don't lead with a spreadsheet. You need something other than numbers. Hopefully the numbers will be supporting you underneath. I'm not expecting anything radically new to come out of the Tasmanian study. I think we already knew the answers. Those people who understand the system down there already knew what the answers were. We're just going to get another publication about it. My gut feeling is that's not going to play the emotive side. Sorry, we've got a queue up there and back here and back here.
Just to the question to the panel as a whole, just wondering, urban forestry seems to be something that is slipping by with nothing really in your degree courses being aimed at it. And it seems to me that urban forestry is actually a very critical and important place to be.
Yeah. We did one semester on urban forestry when John Banks was still here. And that was quite beneficial for us. And in my role at GHD, I actually use that training a lot. I work a lot in the urban forestry area. So I think that it gave the background to urban forestry enough to be able to build on those skills in the workforce. If that helps. There was some emphasis, I think, during our degree on urban forestry. It wasn't everything, obviously, but it was when I went through anyway. I don't know if it's different now.
There is at least one course still offered by the Fenner School that deals with sort of urban landscapes, and urban forestry is something that's touched on in several other courses as well. So, yeah, it is addressed in some respect.
What I would say to actually produce urban forestry and
there's an instance of forestry, that's right, yeah. And we still do teach urban forestry, and part of the goal is you take the general forestry, the mensuration, the silviculture, the establishment, all that, and put it in the context of people who are very prepared to write to their ministers as soon as something goes wrong, and all sorts of other constraints, and manage it that way. So it's a fascinating one of our active research areas here, and there are students involved in it. But again, they may not be forestry students. They could be forest science students, policy students, law students, who are looking at that aspect of the urban forest estate.
I'll just add one thing, and that is that there is a lot of interest in urban forestry, and within our faculty, the coursework Forest Masters has 60-something students in it, but the Master of Urban Horticulture, which includes urban forestry aspects, is the only one that eclipses us with 80-something students. So it's not defined clearly in the program, but it's there, and everyone's talking about urban forestry.
I think that's a general problem sometimes. We don't use the terms that we used to anymore, but the content's there. So just introduce yourself. Thanks, if you...
My name's Tim McNaught, a graduate from a few years ago, back in the late 90s. I now work for one of the federal departments here. But I had worked for a state government forest agency for about 8 or 9 years. I'm just wondering, given the politicisation of forestry and the focus on economic outcomes for businesses, how easy is it to be a leader and in regards to forestry as opposed to just a forest manager?
One of you guys better take that one.
Having been one of those leaders, I can tell you it's pretty hard. In fact, very, very hard. And I know a number of other people who've held jobs as heads of forest agencies or whatever who've found it very hard. And if John Dargavel's over there, but the thing that really struck me when I read his book about the first conservative forest in Western Australia, just how similar the story there was to what happens today. So, you know, leadership's an important thing. And it's also, you know, I'd be a great supporter in saying that we need continuing good leaders in the forestry areas, right around Australia, in policy and in practice, but it's tough going and nothing really prepares you for it until you're actually in there.
And I'm intrigued, looking back at my own career, I was going to be a dirt forester. I was convinced I was going to manage a Pinus radiata plantation for the rest of my life, and it didn't happen. And partly, of course, I think because of the training you have in the degree. You do a little bit of everything, you can talk to everybody, and that gives you the opportunity of seeing things from different viewpoints. And that's often what a leader is required to do, to see a whole lot and bring it into a new vision. So the wide breadth of the old forestry degree, which were compulsory to be wide breadth, I think did bring the opportunity in to make it easy for you to be a leader, provided you had the personal inclination and the stuff of the slings and arrows. You know, you go up ahead and someone will shoot you. That's what happens, especially in forestry.
I would like to suggest, it'll take 1 minute. I am a forester who's been at the game for 60 years. Now, I have used most of the information that I received at the forestry school, which happened to be the Australian Forestry School. I had the advantage of having some science at CSIRO initially, when I was a student, and my concern, I don't believe that the course, for instance, that's going to be here is satisfactory for the future. I entirely agree very much with Chris Weston when he talks about the understanding of the core subjects, and the Institute of Foresters says silviculture, forest management, forest ecology, menstruation, inventory, forest fire management are the leading ones that one should have. And I'd like to ask the panel whether they think that the problem about leadership is picking students rather than hoping to God they turn up.
Do you mean, like, as in there's a selection process to actually be admitted into forestry? Well, I think now we might be past that point. No one's wanting to do forestry, so we can't even select them, unfortunately. But I'm not really sure whether or not there should be a selection process, because I think that students will usually thin themselves out by the end of it if they're not suited to it or they don't want to do forestry, then they will drop out or they won't pass their courses. So I think there's a bit of a natural selection by the end of the 4 years with forestry anyway. And I think all of us who graduated at the end of, I think there were 12 of us or so,
that graduated, we were all reasonably successful in getting jobs and pursuing our careers in forestry. Does that answer the question a little bit?
I might just say, Bob, that I happen to know that I was not in the first 10 in my year at Creswick in terms of being in the initial selection. Fortunately, someone else dropped out. My academic marks in secondary school weren't good enough. But I actually think that's the passion about what you're interested in that makes more of a difference. So I would challenge really whether academic institutions could really select good people for these disciplines. So I think people have to want to be working in this discipline rather than actually saying, well, hang on, no, you're not good enough type of thing. I think we should have all types of different training opportunities for people to work across the spectrum. No, I don't think it should be only one model where you come in one way. I think it's actually quite good. When I did my postgraduate study at Oxford University, it was a bit of an eye-opener to have people in there doing a master's degree who had no undergraduate forestry qualification, but some of them have gone on to do very significant jobs in world forestry since that time.
That is the model partly of the National Forestry Masters, the British universities are doing. So you've got an undergraduate core and you can build it up through the master's program or come in as Tony was saying, with other expertise and life skills and then use the National Masters to fill in an appropriate degree.
The question posed today has been largely whether the universities are providing the skills necessary for forestry. And I think we've heard a lot about forest science today, and I'm quite reasonably confident that they are playing a role there. But forestry is not all about forest science. If you look at the job ads today, most are for looking for foresters, for supervisory management jobs in forest operations. If you look overseas, Scandinavia, North America, basically one third of the graduates are forest engineers. Australia has never trained forest engineers. It's basically been biologically led since the year dot. Sure, it was a bit more that way inclined in the old AFS, but we can't go backwards. Somehow or other, the universities have got to recognise the need for a credible forest engineering course in Australia, and I would suggest that this is something that a total omission today.
So not actually a question. Okay. Right.
Mike Ryan, Vic Forests. Thanks very much for the presentation this evening. One quick answer to the question as to where we're getting foresters from. South Africa has been one of the sources, and also some locally, and New Zealand. Question for the two Chrises. Chris, I agree with your comment. Foresters aren't brilliant at everything, and if you need to do wildlife surveys, you bring in wildlife biologists, and if you want to build great roads, often you're bringing engineers. How do you folks get your really quality forestry science out there to other parts of the university who are making comments on forestry without the expertise and often getting the science wrong?
The underpinning from, if foresters aren't brilliant at everything, they have to have a smattering of everything so they can talk to those guys, so they can convince those people that they have got it wrong. And that's the thing. So you need a little bit of everything to allow you to talk to the other parts of the institution and the wider population. And I think that's where we fall down a bit, because foresters do have a little bit of everything, and they're worried that their little bit gets trumped by the huge wealth that someone has in a depth. So when you fight someone who is an in-depth restoration ecologist or an in-depth something else, we tend to stand back, whereas our view should have been, what's the so what? What are the boundary conditions? You've gone that deep, but you've left out the side of it. I think that's where we have to go and look for that bit more holistic
view. And that's where I'm looking at that interdisciplinary. You've got to talk to everybody and take that overview and then present it back to them. And the traditional forestry degree wasn't good at presenting it. You know, you crammed the knowledge into it and then you went and did it. You didn't tell anybody about it. You did it. So here's another thing we can add to our degree, telling people. Still, we can add a whole new degree to our degree. We haven't got enough people in time to do it at the moment. We want another one. There's all these things we can keep adding.
I would only add that I think it's really important for foresters to not just talk to foresters, but to talk to the rest of the community, which I think is behind your question. I think that's happening more now than it has in the past, but we're being forced to in a way because we need to stay relevant.
It's also interesting now that our courses are open out to non-foresters. I mean, we do forest mensuration. It's a hardcore forestry topic. We don't call it mensuration. It's too scary. And we're getting lawyers in. So we are enculturating lawyers of the aspects of natural resource management and how it's not a simple thing. Lawyers get used to having... Now, there's the number. If it's 42, then you're illegal. If it's 41, then you're legal. But in natural resources, 42 might not mean 42. And you have to give them the context and the picture. So in that respect, by stealth, we're training them, even though we don't have the forestry numbers to run the course in and of itself. So it's a nice accidental serendipity. It's a plus by accident.
Quick question regarding, I'm starting to delay perhaps the course of, I try and preach forestry to people who've already formed their opinions on what forestry might be about, for example. Is there a way that we can influence the curriculum and start at a younger age? And, for example, the Australian Water Association has been able to have some involvement in the new national curriculum at schools, so they're going to be educating children at primary school level about water issues, water management. Perhaps is there an avenue for forestry to be promoted in a broader perspective in that sort of like the issue of early.
I'll just say I completely agree. I think that there should be some sort of way that we can do that. I don't know how. That's the challenge. But I agree.
Mike knows this, but one of my jobs in Victoria was to set up and run the Talangi Forest Discovery Centre, which was all about that, and we brought teachers in to work in that place to run tours and train or provide information to school children so that the teachers would bring out their school groups to the centre and go out into the forest and have a look at things. And that was initially funded by the Commonwealth Government as one of the RFA processes, and then it was, as soon as that sort of, I can't remember, it was 3 or 4 years worth of funding, it was basically shut down. So, there's just no appetite amongst the funders to do that on a long-term basis.
One other thing I want to mention there is it's interesting now, we've got water management degrees and water science degrees. What's the collective noun for water managers? There isn't one. We have foresters as a collective noun for us. There's no collective noun for water. Is that our problem? I think it's actually, a lot of the government think it's the problem. They just take the word forestry out of everything. There's no debate and argument anymore. So they're hiding behind it. Yeah, maybe we've lost the debate. Maybe we can't use the word forester anymore. That might be one of our things. I mean, as I said, I teach forest conservation. It's a great term, and it's exactly the term that describes what foresters need to know. But I lost the fight. I'm not allowed to call it that. Because we don't get students enrolling it. So maybe if we keep calling forestry, we won't get students enrolling it. Here, there.
Thanks, Chris. Craig Triboli from Forest New South Wales. I'm probably one of the rare people here who's actually an operational forester. One of the strengths of forestry as a graduate was the fieldwork component and also working with industrial forestry organisations as a student over your summers and your holidays. And Melinda raised that point before. That network has certainly broken down, and I know that from experience. We don't have summer students anymore in operational forestry. Why is the network broken down, and how do we fix that? Because I think that's a critical part of students' education. And Chris, we have had master students from Melbourne, and excellent. With their breadth of experience they've brought to that, has been excellent. How do we rebuild those networks? Because I think it's critical.
I'm not sure who rang me last year, but there was somebody from State Forest New South Wales who rang with exactly that question, and we attempted to re-establish the old kind of opportunities program, and we certainly do that sort of thing through our professional links as a group of researchers and academics, and I'm sure the same happens here in ANU, but great idea, let's try and formalise it.
I mean, there are administrative issues, there's health and safety issues, but so I came from the good old days, and it would be horrible. I actually had a whole year working as a field trainee. So a whole year I went around the state, and I got paid to do that as part of my forestry degree. Lovely, let's bring it back. All I need is for someone to donate. How many students have got that many times, what, $25,000, $30,000? That's cheap. But who's going to do the donation these days?
My name is Sandra Velarde. I'm a PhD student at a Crawford School. I'm a forest engineer, so my heart is with Fenner. I always say that. So I come from Peru, and I see very similar issues about being multidisciplinary, forestry being multidisciplinary, and that you cannot really define what a forester is, especially nowadays, forest experts for carbon sequestration and things like that. So it's just a kind of a suggestion probably about how to make forestry studies a little bit more sexy for, you know, recruiting. And it's something that we have had at my school back in Peru, which is a series of field semesters, actually. So it's not just a field trip or a field day, but it's 2 months completely outside with your teachers in modules. So you have like the 2 weeks forest mensuration, for example, 2 weeks intensive silviculture, etc., etc., and some days in Canberra or, you know, in the city before and after. And that we do for forest management, and also we do for forest industry. So we'll have one semester on the field in a tropical area, and the other one, again, in a tropical area, but more looking at the industry part and talking to industry people. And that's mandatory, actually.
Last question. The food has arrived now, so we're in our own time now. So.
I'm a former graduate of this college, and I'm not in the industry for personal reasons, but I found while I was going through the course, it almost became a dirty word to say that you're a forester. And when Chris said he can't own up to calling it forest mensuration because people are going to shy away from it, is that really us burying our head in the sand and bowing down to a movement that's not helping us? And in that case, like, the mining industry has got the same problems, but instead of burying their head in the sand, they've actually gone and said, well, no, this is what we do. Look at us. And for Tony, as you lose Australian foresters, and, like, how can we maintain our position as a world leader in expertise?
Well, that one's easy. We just need more people to get an interest and get a first step into working in international development. So what I'm trying to do is pair people up with experienced people to get some new, younger people involved in projects. So I think there's no end of people who would be interested in that type of work. The other part of your question, though, well, and if we don't get enough, then I start employing more scientists from the International Forest Research Institutes. That's because the money's there to run the projects. So there's opportunities, and I'm talking to a whole pile of universities about this as I get free time to go around and talk to them. But I think, you know, that it will solve itself one way or another because the money's there for the projects. The other part, though, you know, I don't know. I've kind of had that same issue right through my career, but sometimes you've got to be... Like when I come back from my travels, when you write on the form, what's your profession, I write down forester. And every time the quarantine man looks at me and says, oh, do you go in any forests? Because I hadn't ticked that box or something or other. And said, no, I just went to a meeting in an office somewhere or whatever. But, you know, when I've been to barbecues, my wife's a teacher, and I used to always get hammered by these teachers in the Otways when we lived there in the 1980s because they were all greenies down there. And but I just used to try and say, well, actually, do you really know what I do? You know, I don't get up in the morning and go out there thinking, what a great day, I'm going to go and cut down all these trees today. And even if I do supervise a harvesting operation, why am I doing that? Have you used any paper? Good question to ask someone at, you know, a dinner party is, how many reams of paper did you buy at the supermarket this week? And where did it come from? Oh, I don't know. But, you know, I think we, all of us in the profession need to actually not be afraid to say that we work in that area and use the informal opportunities as they come to actually talk proudly about what you do and what you know and to challenge some other views. That's kind of what I've always done.
You said that was the last question, and I think food is waiting things. I'm actually going to ask one question because I haven't yet. What would be the perfect job when you finish? You might as well ask for it now, but I think it's a good question to wrap this up. What would be the perfect job for our next graduate? Okay, it has to do with forests, all right? So you're open to offers here tonight. Look, we're going to wrap up the formal part of this. Some thank yous to Sharon and Louise and others for organising this tonight and for the IFA for cooperating and helping this book together. I'm going to say something you might not like, but we proved them wrong. Someone said, oh, you're running one on forestry. I can see what the demographic would be like for that meeting. Have a look around. It's pretty healthy. We've got everything from fresh young faces to experienced old hands and all sorts of different perspectives and a very good roll-up. So thanks very much for coming along. I think there's been some great points raised, which we listen to. Don't know what we can do about them, but we'll try. And it's a moment in a discussion that's going to go on, not just in this aspect of managing Australia's landscape. But a big thank you to Chris, Ellie, Mel and Tony, thanks very much for that. And could we thank them again? The next one of these is on the 29th of April. Richard Green, who's hiding up the back, is... Huh? May. Okay, I'm an academic. No idea what day it is. And it'll be on a similar discussion around agricultural lands. And if you talk to the Council of Australian Agricultural Deans, who have meetings in a phone box, they have very similar issues about future skills, the supply of people into agricultural science and so on. And now, if you can join us for refreshments, the easiest way is to go straight that way through the bridge to the new building and take the stairs just to the right there and you'll find us. And come over, have something to eat and drink and continue the discussion. And thanks very much again.